Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a special look at race and people of color in U.S. journalism. Told quickly, it's a story about underrepresentation and exclusion, of bias and of breakthroughs. And all along, recognition that the stories news media tell us about the world and one another are a tremendous shaping force on the state of racial and ethnic understanding and the advance of social justice. We'll hear from Joseph Torres of the group Free Press, co-author with Juan Gonzalez of a new book called News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. It's full of history and people that have gone largely missing from most folks' understanding of journalism in this country, and it also talks about why that is. Also on the show, demands for increased diversity are a constant with corporate media. But what's it like for the journalists of color who represent that diversity once they're on the job? We learned more recently from the book Uncovering Race, a Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. Counterspin's Peter Hart spoke with the book's author, reporter Amy Alexander. All of that is coming up right away. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. It's impossible to overestimate the importance of knowing and remembering history. Many things people imagine to be new are not. Many notions of how things came to be as they are mistaken. Many people who were pivotal are forgotten. This is as true in the history of journalism as anywhere, and maybe particularly true when it comes to U.S. news media's relationship with people of color and issues of race. Said another way, you've probably heard of Upton Sinclair. Have you heard of Pedro Gonzalez? You know about Amos and Andy, but did you know that at one point fully 10% of the country's black population engaged in protest of the show? Or that there were nearly 100 Spanish language newspapers before the Civil War? News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media, is the new void-filling book co-authored by Daily News and Democracy Now! Reporter Juan Gonzalez and our next guest, Joseph Torres. Joe Torres is Senior Advisor for Government and External Affairs at Free Press. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Joe Torres.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
I had to do an extra long intro to give some sense of the breadth of the book because we can't address all of it here. But let me ask you first, some see media as a field that grew naturally, as it were, but has lately been regulated by the government. One lesson of the book is that the government has always taken an interest, always played a role in news from the first papers in colonial times, right? There's always been media policy, if you will, and that's always had meaning for people of color.
That's right. You know, we talk about in the book that the creation of our newspaper industry in our country really began with the creation of the post office. The U.S. Postal Act of 1792 created a post office, and one of the things they said was that they were going to subsidize the delivery of mail. So the cost of delivering letters to folks were very expensive, but that money was used to subsidize for very cheaply the delivery of newspapers throughout the country. And the other thing they said to the Postal Act, that they were not going to have any surveillance of the mail. So what this effectively did, it created a newspaper industry. We went from having just a few hundred newspapers to several thousand newspapers in just a matter of 30 or 40 years. What it also did, it allowed people of color to create their own newspapers, despite the horrific discrimination happening, you know, slavery and the horrific discrimination happening in our country. There was nearly 30 African-American newspapers created before the Civil War. The Freedom's Journal, the first African-American newspaper in 1827, first Spanish language newspaper in 1808, first Native American newspaper, Cherokee Phoenix, in 1828. So the Postal Act created a decentralized system, a media system that allow the voices of many to be heard and allow people of color to actually tell their own stories, which is quite remarkable.
Well, the book comes at the issue a number of ways. One of them is the missing history of the African-American and Native American, other so-called ethnic press. And another is just the relationship between people of color and the press. Some of the tropes and patterns that we see in media coverage today are older than the country. But it goes beyond bias and underrepresentation, doesn't it, to violence. Can you talk a little about that history?
We have about a dozen at least examples in which newspapers played a critical central role in the lynching of African Americans, Native Americans, the killing of Chinese immigrants in California, Native Americans being driven from their land. I mean, for instance, Andrew Jackson, all the Southern papers supported Andrew Jackson because he was known as the great Indian remover. He was going to remove the Cherokee from their land, and in Georgia, and the Trail of Tears happened. This newspapers pushed this policy. They pushed the racist policy that allowed for Indian removal and to help elect Andrew Jackson. The most tragic example is in Wilmington, North Carolina, where this Southern publisher is a historic figure in journalism, a guy named Josephus Daniels, the publisher of the Raleigh News in North Carolina. In Wilmington, North Carolina, in 1898, there was a fusion government between Republicans and free African Americans, a government where blacks actually had leadership roles and prominent places in society. And the Democrats won election of the state houses, basically took control of the state houses, and they got rid of, by violence, the African-American leaders in Wilmington, North Carolina. It was a coup of the local government in North Carolina. The person who led that was Josephus Daniels, the publisher of the Raleigh News. He bragged about it. He instigated it with his newspapers, publishing his outlandish stories. And Josephus Daniels wasn't just some nut job. He was the Secretary of Navy during the World War I. He was the ambassador to Mexico of FDR. But yet, journalism history treats him as a great journalistic figure who stood up against corporate power. But yet, they paper over the role he played in the massacre of 60 African Americans. We give a lot of examples of this in the book and show the dangers of what happens when you have a white racial narrative, when people of color are unable to control and tell their own stories, when other people tell our stories, they get it wrong and they cause us great harm.
When then there are also so many great stories of papers and of people that have not become, as you say, part of the sort of general cultural memory bank. I heard Juan Gonzalez tell the story of John Roland Ridge, a Cherokee Indian writer who founded the Sacramento Bee, later sold it to James McClatchy, who worked for him, though if you look on their website today, there's no mention of John Roland Ridge, the Cherokee Indian who was the paper's first editor and publisher. What's a story that stands out for you, and what is the impact of not knowing these stories?
Historically, folks have very little knowledge that an ethnic press ever existed or exists. Still to this day, people are very unaware of an ethnic press. It's always been true throughout history, but yet the ethnic newspapers and ethnic publications have played a critical role in communities of color. One of my favorite stories that you mentioned in the intro was the whole campaign of the Pittsburgh Courier to try to get Amos and Andy off the air. And, you know, when radio was first regulated in 1927, all the most powerful stations in the country, all the clear channel stations basically, were turned over to CBS and NBC. And the most popular radio program in the country was Amos and Andy, you know, blackface minstrel show with white actors. And half of the nation's listening audience were listening to Amos and Andy every night. The Pittsburgh Courier, which was one of the most important African-American newspapers at the time with a huge circulation, decided to run a campaign to try to ask the Federal Radio Commission to get Amos and Andy off the air. And literally, over a course of a year, they got 720,000 people to write a petition that was sent to the Federal Radio Commission demanding that the program get removed from the air because the racism, the whole hearing to determine whether this program serves a public interest. And the Federal Radio Commission never responded. But it was really the first effort by African-Americans, the first effort by people of color, really, to try to reform the media during the broadcast era. People of color have always cared about media policy, have always fought for a just media system, and still, too often, their voices are being ignored. To this day, I mean, people of color only own 3% of all TV stations, 8% of all radio stations, and the federal government is about to introduce new rules to allow for further consolidation without understanding the impact it can have on ownership of color. So our voices continue to be marginalized in federal policy to this day.
Well, and we have talked on the show recently about the so-called new digital divide, not that we've bridged the old one, but between those who have access to a high-speed internet and those who only have phone access, who are overwhelmingly poor people and people of color, who have access to a kind of second-tier restricted internet that the FCC has said is not going to be subject to the same regulations, such as they are, that govern internet connections through broadband. Here's something where a media policy can have racial impact, even though there's nothing written in the law about race, per se.
Whenever technology comes along, it fundamentally changes the media system. It creates new industries, whether it's a telegraph, radio, cable, now the internet. And the government has a central role. Does it regulate to allow the voices of the many to participate, or does it turn over control to the hands of a few? People of color have always argued that it should be controlled by the hands of many. But the media should not be consolidated and controlled by the hands of a few, but the voices of the many should be able to participate. With the internet, progressive people of color have argued that, but unfortunately, we talk about in the book as well, the role of the historic civil rights groups have argued actually against more openness on the internet. It's a baffling new trend that has just emerged over the past decade, arguing for Comcast to own NBC, and how is that going to help people of color when you consolidate so much media in the hands of a few? So the fight for internet right now, open internet right now, is kind of splintered the community. We need an open internet to make sure that we can tell our own stories.
Finally, are you surprised by the response to a book that is in some ways a call out on what's going before, saying these are aspects of history, these are people, these are outlets that have been missed, that have not been engaged? And it's being very well received. It's a New York Times bestseller.
I think that there is a hunger for this information because while most people do not like the media, people of color despise the media because of the harm it has caused us historically. And I think there is a hunger to understand how this has happened. And I think one of the things about the book that I think people walk away from is that there's always been heroic figures fighting for a just media system, that the fight going on today, that they're not alone, that there's been other heroic figures like Ida B. Wells and Pedro Drake Gonzalez. This is a long arc, and they're part of it, and I think they should take great strength from the Frederick Douglasses of the world and folks who came before them.
We've been speaking with Joseph Torres of Free Press, co-author with Juan Gonzalez of the new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media, out now from Verso Books. Thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
In the abstract, big media companies care about diversity in their newsrooms, and they speak of appreciating and celebrating at times the idea that diverse perspectives produce diverse and better journalism. In the real world, progress on this front is somewhere between slow and non-existent. It's one thing to track these events from the outside or to participate in the debates over creating a healthier, more diverse media. It's quite another thing to have lived it. That kind of experience informs a new book by reporter Amy Alexander. It is called Uncovering Race, A Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. It's available now from Beacon Press. Amy Alexander joins us now on the phone. Welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
One of the tensions throughout the book was how you and other reporters reconcile or try to settle or grapple with these two identities, being a person of color and being a journalist at a major media company. It's an industry that sort of prides itself on reporters not having a slant or a bias. But the rules for journalists of color can be rather hard to navigate sometimes. There's a sense that there's a burden on journalists of color to prove themselves, particularly if they're covering issues of race and racism. Talk to us about how you've experienced that or seen that over your career.
Right. Describing it as a point of tension is very accurate. It's interesting to consider that much of that has kind of lessened just in the past, I'd say, half dozen years. But if you, for example, consider the coverage of something like that obviously has a big race component, such as, you know, the federal government's poor treatment of the Hurricane Katrina victims, in record time, it became a story about race and class. And I think that was kind of a large example of an important turning point. And part of it has to do with, as I said, the fact that media companies are struggling, and they're kind of willing to let reporters sort of let loose, right? Mm-hmm. Which wasn't the case when I began 25 years ago. But to, you know, get back to the meat of your question, when I began in working in newspapers, it was. It was very sort of cut and dried, and we, you know, I was trained in good old-fashioned shoe leather reporting, and I was sort of behind the fourth wall, which is something of a theatrical term, but what it means is you were just the vehicle conveying the facts, and you didn't really have contact with readers or the now what we think of as the audience beyond your contact with them on any given story, at the source or the witness, at the fire, or at a quote from a parent at a school board meeting. There wasn't the kind of back and forth that there is now. We were required to just tell what had gone on, give it some context, ideally lay on some interesting writing. You know, your creativity would come into play in terms of how you were able to sort of write engaging and compelling copy. But you were all, you know, you're always required to tell the truth, tell it accurately, and pretty much just stick to the facts. Now, that is still the model, obviously, and that's the ideal. But it's really different now, and journalists of color and all journalists are really right now sort of trying to find solid footing in a media landscape that is just in tumult right now.
You know, one of the things that I thought was most intriguing, and maybe it's those quote-unquote early years, but there was a sense, and you cited a couple of examples, where white reporters covering communities of color were considered somehow more trustworthy or that they didn't have this baggage that, say, a black reporter covering a black neighborhood or racism would have to deal with.
Right.
And some of that attitude seems to come from the top. You tell a story early on in your career about being let go from a major newspaper and one of the editors saying, well, you'll be fine because, you know, you're a black woman and we know that black women get jobs in mainstream journalism.
Right. Right. It was, I laugh about it now because it was just so sort of twisty and absurd, isn't it? You're referring to my first daily newspaper job, which was in my hometown of San Francisco. And yes, I worked there in college. I was a very eager Beaver Cub reporter, you know, and they tapped me to sort of be their intern that would be transitioned into a full-time reporting job. And in my first year as full-time reporter, at the end of that first year, I was told that my position was being eliminated. And the conversation from that Metro editor was so stunning to me. And it was so, it just rolled out of his mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, like, why are you upset? You won't have a problem finding another job. And I'm sitting there like with my jaw hanging open. And I didn't push back with him in that moment. But later on, as I also recount in the book, the managing editor of the San Francisco Examiner at that time is a legendary newspaper man named Frank McCulloch, who looks like General Patton, you know, and he's an old school guy. And he called me in his office. He'd heard I was upset, and he sat me down and he said, it's ridiculous that we're letting you go, but you need to understand that this industry at this time, you will have to deal with this dynamic of news organizations as an institution saying that they want to bring in more women, they want to bring in more people of color, but when the rubber meets the road, you will oftentimes be faced with the prospect of being pushed out because you're one of the most recent hires.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so you've got to kind of buck up and deal with it.
There is we've been talking about the future of the business and people have been talking about this for years, there are these business decisions that impact how media companies cover communities of color. We're not speaking of an industry that should operate or does operate based on its noble intentions. You've seen some of that at work and you write about it in the book. Newspapers that will start publishing a separate Spanish language edition or section,
right,
shifting resources to suburban areas. There are choices that these companies have made,
mm-hmm,
that might explain their difficulty attracting readers.
What I tried to do in this book was to not cast all the publishers and all the corporations that own, because most of them are now owned by corporations. I did not want to give the impression that it's black and white, no pun intended, that there's some evil overlord that's just repressing, you know, news about people of color or poor people, or repressing journalists who are, like me, very talented and very ambitious and know how to do good journalism. But because of the long history of a certain kind of owner of these organizations and a certain expectation about what creates profitability, it's just, it's like a big ball of solid mindset that has been really hard for the leaders of these groups to sort of get over and get through. A lot of entrenched thinking is sort of breaking down little by little. The proposition of diversifying newsrooms or having newsrooms that are more inclusive has been a longer issue. It's been on the table longer, beginning, as I describe in the book briefly, you know, most traditional news organizations in America really only started bringing in journalists of color in earnest like around the time of the urban riots in the 60s mm-hmm. through roughly the early 70s. So the trajectory is not really that long, but they had to sort of finally admit, the top editors and some of the publishers, especially the papers that were owned by families, finally had to admit, how are we going to do a better job of covering these communities that are going up in flames if we can't even get a reporter to get into the neighborhoods and talk to the people to find out really what's going on. So, and the Kerner Commission report, of course, you know, helped push that line of thinking. So little by little, starting in roughly, you know, in earnest in about the mid-60s, I mean, there have always been little sprinklings of black and Latino journalists, and certainly in the major metropolitan markets for much of the last part of the 19th century up through the mid-20th century. But that hiring really began, you could start measuring numbers of people who are like me, women also, entering newsrooms as reporters or as desk assistants, and then they got elevated up to reporting and then into the editing ranks. So the golden era really was between roughly the late 70s through about the early 90s. And cite figures from I think it's a Knight Ritter study mm-hmm. that says that the peak of quote-unquote newsroom diversity was pretty much around the early 90s. And then there's been a significant drop since then. I do wonder about the future of how a lot of these issues and communities of color will be covered. But at the same time, as the Internet, you know, becomes more rich and fertile with different kinds of independent news organizations, there is obviously a possibility that some of these web-only publications will sort of sprout and bloom into becoming a kind of a more full-service news organization. It hasn't really happened yet. What you're seeing, what you mentioned in your comment and question was, you know, yes, back in 20 years ago, you had the Knight Ritter Company that would put up a Spanish-language paper in Miami, and that was their attempt to capture Spanish-speaking readers. Well, now the counterpart to that on the web is a company like the Washington Post Corporation that in 08 put up a black website called theroot.com. And it's, you know, on the one hand, you could consider it, well, this is ghettoization. You know, why do you have to have coverage of black people be set off on a separate site? Why don't you just filter it all through your main product, which is the very legendary Washington Post newspaper? So I suppose it could cut both ways.
You know, your career has spanned that the very beginnings of that Internet reporting era, and there is this whole cottage industry devoted to debating and predicting the quote-unquote future of media, and it mm-hmm. often boils down to a few guys arguing right. that legacy media is over, stop worrying about big newspapers, the future is this exciting moment, everyone can be a blogger, you just hang your shingle out, and the best things are going to rise to the top and they're going to cover the world comprehensively. Tell us a little bit about how that discussion about the future of media looks to you, given what you've seen. You mentioned the promise of it, but there also have been some obvious problems. The new media has never really seemed to be a particularly diverse media.
That's right. And, you know, I'm gonna have to sort of, I mean, I won't pull punches, but I will tread somewhat lightly because I know a lot of these guys. And the same kind of myopia, which existed in the main news organizations for many years, around hiring and promotions, which is to say the hiring managers pretty much all knew each other. They all fit a certain profile. And so there's a comfort factor that exists. And this is an organizational truism. I mean, it's not unique to journalism. But what I mean is the gatekeeper will probably be more inclined to hire someone with whom they feel familiar and or comfortable. So that means, oh, you went to the same college I went to, or you went to the same college my brother went to, or, you know, oh, you grew up in the, you know, one neighborhood over or one state over from where I grew up. These sort of signifiers that psychologically create a comfort zone that enable a kind of consistent hiring pattern that affected coverage and affected the way newsrooms were staffed. And I personally witnessed this over many years, okay? So now at these new media outfits, the same dynamic exists. That has not gone away. And so, yes, even while there are all these independent sites and some of them are kind of scrappy and, you know, you have these hyper-local sites that are some of the big companies are putting up, or independent nonprofit, or these hybrid groups that are sort of partially funded by a foundation and partially funded by contributions from readers, the gatekeepers are still kind of the same type, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm just fascinated by it because it's like everything old is new again. Mm-hmm. And even though the landscape around these news organizations obviously has changed, which is to say the demographics in America are becoming more ethnically diverse, we know that by 2050, if not sooner, this will be a quote-unquote majority-minority nation. And so you have to kind of wonder, where is the leadership, and shouldn't there be leadership from some source that sort of can be an eye in the sky and really encourage the leaders, whether it's of a new media organization or of a traditional news organization that's sort of morphing into being web only, to do a better job of hiring editorial staffs who will have to go out and get the news about the way America is changing.
We've been speaking with Amy Alexander. Her book is called Uncovering Race, a Black Journalist's Story of Reporting and Reinvention. It's available now from Beacon Press. You can find her work at Amy Alexander, Inc., that's with a K, at amyalexanderinc.com. Amy Alexander, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Bill Seary at Mercer Media. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.